This is Embodied on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Herpes is the boogeyman of sexually transmitted infections. Popular culture and media narratives tell us that a diagnosis is a lifelong curse, and that herpes is something that happens to other people. But statistics show you have most certainly encountered someone with herpes.
I asked them if they've ever shared a drink with someone or smoked somebody's cigarette or done anything where you're just kind of casually exchanging saliva with someone that you trust, perhaps. But if that's true, then you've exposed yourself to the herpes virus.
An estimated 1 in 8 people in the U.S. carries the strand of herpes virus that most commonly causes genital herpes. But many people still know so little about it, and that makes the experience of a positive diagnosis confusing and even isolating. Ella Dawson is a sex and culture critic who writes and speaks about her experience with herpes as a way to fight stigma. Her projects include her Ask Ella Herpes Advice column. Ella, welcome to The State of Things.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. This has been such an interesting process of getting ready for this conversation because it has illuminated to me just how much misinformation is out there. And I know we're going to kind of unpack a lot of that throughout the course of the show, but I'd love to start with a bit of your own personal story. You got a positive herpes diagnosis when you were in your early 20s. Tell us a bit about that experience.
Sure. Well, I was wrapping up my junior year of college, and I was actually a few days shy of my 21st birthday when I woke up one morning with an outbreak of herpes. And at the time, I had that panicked moment of, oh God, what is this? Could this be cuts from shaving or something strange? And I went to Google, and Google pointed in one direction. And thankfully, I had a great experience receiving medical care at the student clinic on campus, and the doctors there were very kind, but said, you know, this is absolutely herpetic. Welcome to the secret society. And it was a traumatic experience, even though I received such good care. A herpes diagnosis can throw you into such an identity crisis because I had spent my entire life absorbing all of these horrible stereotypes about the type of person who got STIs. And it really threw me for an emotional loop. And I struggled with insecurity and confusion and guilt and embarrassment. And it was incredibly disruptive, and it absolutely ruined my 21st birthday.
Well, talk about that. You said the kind of person that gets herpes. And I think that that's one of the kind of reigning myths about this is that, you know, it is someone who is promiscuous or someone who's engaging in infidelity. And that is just so not the case. What do you make of kind of that stigma and the narrative about the kind of person who gets herpes?
Absolutely. There are a lot of stereotypes that we learn through sex education or just from pop culture that the type of person who gets an STI, especially herpes, is someone who has been reckless, someone who is irresponsible and selfish. Usually we associate it with infidelity and deception. So there's this real sense that if you have an STI, you have some kind of moral failing. And I think that's particularly true for young women because we already are so aware that our sexual behavior is seen as a reflection of our value and of our femininity. And so to find myself 21 years old in college, newly sexually active, diagnosed with an STI, I felt like I was this failure of a human and that I was disgusting and a threat to the people that I loved. And thankfully, the people in my life who knew me, who I confided in about my diagnosis, immediately told me, you're not a slut, you're not a terrible person, there's no such thing, and this is just a virus. But I had unknowingly absorbed so many messages that told me that my STI was a punishment for my behavior as a normal, sexually active 20-something, and that I had gotten what I deserved. And it took me a really long time to unlearn that and to realize that a virus is just a virus, and it's not a reflection of my worth as a human being.
Well, you mentioned kind of that Google rabbit hole that you went down on, you know, the night that you were diagnosed, and it seems like that's a very common part of the narrative for a lot of people because the existing information that we have is so limited, and the existing journalism even on herpes is really misleading. There was this really notable moment in herpes journalism journalism history in the early 1980s that I know you have talked about, where Time magazine had this cover story, and it called herpes the new scarlet letter. And that really set the tone for the way journalism reported on herpes, kind of doing all of these profiles of anonymous people who've had these diagnoses, and shapes our understanding of who has it and the need to keep it a secret. Talk a bit about herpes journalism and what you've uncovered about it since your own diagnosis.
Yeah, my my dad actually had that Time magazine cover framed for me. It's above my desk. I think it's really funny. most journalism about herpes is very sensationalist, and it engages in disease mongering, where you make a virus like herpes into this social boogeyman that reflects fears about sexual behavior at the time. And most herpes journalism that I see is, it's typically not written from a scientific perspective. It's not written by science journalists. And you'll see a lot of stories, like a few years ago, there was a spike of herpes and other STIs associated with a music festival. I can't remember which one it was, but it was this very alarmist, oh my God, STI rates are spiking. And all of that coverage just adds more fear around STIs, as opposed to providing information and context about how common they are, how minimal their side effects usually are, and how to go get tested and then live with an STI in a healthy way afterward. The goal is usually to create panic and get a bunch of people to read or to click. And I won't rag on journalists. I'm from a family of journalists, but I think particularly in an age of digital media where you're competing for attention, STIs are a great way to have an easy click, because I think they're this boogeyman that all of us are raised to be so afraid of, as opposed to a normal part of being a human being. And STIs are not all transmitted by fluids. They can be transmitted by skin contact. So I think a lot of folks feel like they are immune to STIs because of their behavior or the steps that they take. And so some of that coverage can be alarmist of, you're not as safe as you thought you were, which again just creates more confusion, more panic, and more judgment of people who do wind up contracting a virus. But I love that Time feature from the 80s, as horrific as it is. I think it's such a clear example of what we're talking about. It depicted herpes as this scarlet letter and talked about all these people who were spreading it willfully. And it's just, it's full of garbage, but those myths persist today. And it's worth holding up as an example of absolutely getting it wrong.
So you have been public about your diagnosis. Obviously, you're talking with us today, and you've been speaking, and you gave a TEDx talk, and you've been on this journey for a number of years. Could you tell us a bit about what this experience of being public has been like, and why you decided to do it in the first place?
Sure. It's very strange being a public figure associated with herpes. It's always funny when somebody Googles my name and then it suggests Ella Dawson herpes to complete your search. It's definitely odd. I decided to become more public about having herpes because when I was diagnosed, all I really wanted was to see other people's real life experiences. I wanted people to relate to who weren't anonymous and who were like me, so that I had role models and felt less alone. And so my work really stems from what I wish that I had had when I was that vulnerable 20, 21-year-old girl. And it's been a wild ride. It's very strange to have something that is so private be public. And it's been certainly odd to have job interviews where someone Googles me, or to have a boyfriend's parents Google me. And it's definitely a little strange. But what I found is that herpes is so common that everyone has had some kind of experience with it, whether it's a past partner or a family member or themselves. And as a result, I usually am greeted with more curiosity and open-mindedness than I am judgment. And there are occasionally people who kind of cringe and go, ew, that's disgusting. And I've certainly had moments where I've had to stand up for myself in awkward social situations, but in general, people are really gracious and grateful, because it's this huge void in our conversation about health. And I think folks are just so encouraged to see folks like me standing up and saying, this is part of my life. It's not a big deal. I am a really cool, well-rounded human. And this is just one part of how my life works. And I've been really pleasantly surprised by how nice people are about it.
I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now who's going to talk a bit more about that knowledge that can empower us to have less misconceptions and less stigma around a positive herpes diagnosis. We heard from a listener who talked about the experience of getting a positive herpes diagnosis and trying to figure out what was happening in her body.
I could only get to the point where I felt like I could share with anybody, even a therapist, somebody I was, paying to listen to me. That I had herpes was after I got educated about how many people have it and what it means to have it, what it means for your body, what it means for your potential partners, what it means for childbirth, what it means for everything.
Joining us now is Dr. Peter Leone. He's a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine and an adjunct associate professor of epidemiology at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health. Welcome to The State of Things, Peter.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So let's start with some of the science here. So culturally, we hear a lot about oral herpes versus genital herpes, but that already kind of points to some of the misconceptions about the division between the two. So if you could just start by giving us an overview of the different types of herpes.
Sure. So there are 8 herpes viruses that infect humans. 2 of them, herpes simplex 1 and 2, are the ones that we're talking about today. HSV-1 causes cold sores. HSV-2 causes genital lesions, but we now know that HSV-1 can also infect the genital tract. And so this artificial division about HSV-1 only occurs above the waist and HSV-2 only occurs below the waist really doesn't hold. And we've already alluded to the statistics before that about 1 in 8 adults in the United States have genital HSV-2 infection. It turns out that for HSV-1, it's almost 50% of adults in the U.S. have HSV-1 infection. The problem is, from a blood test, you can't tell the location. And we're seeing now a real increase in genital HSV-1 infection. In fact, the majority of new infections of the genital tract due to herpes are actually due to HSV-1. So I really appreciate Ella sharing her story and history, and I do think that it's important for people to know if they get diagnosed with genital herpes, which type it is. Is it HSV-1 or HSV-2? Because the natural history and the way you would approach treatment and prevention are very different.
So why is it that so many people have HSV-1 or 2 and don't know that they have it?
Well, that has to do with the fact that we didn't have great tools in the past from diagnosing herpes. So before we had culture and PCR tests where we could check for the DNA of the virus or even blood tests that will allow us to detect antibodies, it was a visual diagnosis. So it required someone coming in with lesions and someone being able to look at it and say, that's herpes. We then had cultures, but cultures were relatively insensitive and weren't being done on people who did not have sores or lesions at the time that they presented. As a result, what you saw written up in medical textbooks and in lay literature was a description of genital herpes that was a disease state, but not typical for how most people present or what the natural history of herpes is. As a result, people think that if they don't have, sores and painful blisters, that they don't have herpes is really a misnomer. In fact, about 85% of folks with genital herpes due to HSV-2 aren't aware that they have it, yet they can have outbreaks and shed virus in the absence of any lesions and therefore can transmit it to partners.
And I guess a big part of this is that the virus manifests really differently in different bodies. And Ella, maybe you could tell us a bit about the process of uncovering how the virus manifests in your own body and learning how to manage that.
Sure. So I am one of those folks who has genital herpes, but I have HSV-1. And so my outbreaks have been fairly minimal. I had a pretty awful first outbreak of herpes back in 2013. That initial outbreak is often the most severe and intense that folks have, and often they can get more mild over time. For me, I had that first outbreak, and then I went 2 years without any symptoms whatsoever, which was very strange, honestly, to have this heavily stigmatized virus and not really experience it. I wasn't sure if I would ever have another outbreak. And then in 2015, I traveled for work internationally and worked a very stressful conference and then had my second outbreak, which was psychologically upsetting because it brought back the trauma and humiliation of that first outbreak. But in terms of physical symptoms, it was much more mild. I had a few different sores and it was uncomfortable, but there wasn't the same level of pain. And then I went another few years before having my third outbreak, which was very minimal. I wasn't even entirely sure if it was an outbreak. I could have been something else, but out of caution, I just decided to treat it like one. And so for me, my herpes outbreaks were really mild, but the psychological weight of having herpes made it difficult for me to feel connected to my body again. It felt like this very alien experience to have this outbreak of a virus. And for a long time, I felt like my body had betrayed me and was this other entity. And it took me a long time and the help of some wonderful supportive partners, as well as just educating myself to understand that the virus lives in my body and my body is still me. And the virus is just, it's one part of my body. I also get sinus infections and I don't judge my nose for being useless. So it was a bit of a journey, but it's been interesting connecting with other folks who have herpes and hearing how different their symptoms are, whether it's more frequent or in a different strange place in their body. I know folks who have herpes outbreaks in places that aren't their mouth or their genitals. I have a colleague who had herpes outbreaks only on the inside of her elbow, which I'm not a scientist, so that's fascinating to me, but it's a very strange virus. And I think everyone has a strange individual experience of herpes while there is a lot of commonality.
Yeah, Peter. I mean, so Ella mentions kind of this idea of, you know, getting comfortable with the fact that it is living inside of you and will manifest in different ways at different points. So how are people treated who do have herpes? What can they do to reduce the risk of transmission once they know that they have a positive diagnosis?
Well, there are several things that you can do that actually do have an impact on reducing transmission and controlling disease, so the frequency of outbreaks. So one of the first things to do actually is to disclose your status, and Ella talked about that. I think it's important for a lot of reasons, both in terms of reducing stigma, but also, for whatever reason, disclosing that you have genital herpes actually does seem to reduce the risk of transmitting it to a partner, even though there aren't any changes that we know of in sexual activities or use of condoms with that sort of disclosure. So one is disclosure. The second is using condoms. And condoms actually offer protection for all sorts of sexually transmitted infections, but in particular seems to reduce the risk of transmitting HSV2. So condoms reduce the transmission from men to women by about 96%. It's less so effective in reducing transmission from a female to a male, but it does reduce it about 65%. So disclosure, condoms, the obvious, not having sex when you're having an active outbreak. And then the fourth is actually daily suppressive therapy. Now, we usually only recommend daily suppressive therapy, where you take a pill every day, for people with genital herpes due to HSV2. And that's because the rate of frequency of recurrences and the shedding of virus in the absence of any signs or lesions is much more, is much higher for HSV2 than for general HSV1. So Ella's history of recurrences of HSV1 is rather typical. Severe first outbreak frequently, and then very infrequent outbreaks after that. Now, if she were having more frequent outbreaks, I would recommend daily suppressive therapy. But generally speaking, we only recommend daily suppressive therapy for genital herpes due to HSV2.
All right. I'm going to have you both stay with us as we continue the conversation just ahead after a short break. And we're going to talk a bit about how to navigate conversations about herpes with friends and romantic partners. Stay with us. This is Embodied on the State of Things. This is Embodied on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Conversations about sex can be challenging, and they can be even more difficult if you're trying to talk about a heavily stigmatized STI like herpes. But disclosing an STI status, no matter what it is, can pave the way for a robust conversation about consent and safe, healthy sex. So what are the best practices for talking about herpes? Tanya Bass is a Southern sexologist and sex educator who's joining us now. Tanya, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Still with me are Ella Dawson, sex and culture critic, and Dr. Peter Leone, a professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine. And I want to start with another clip from one of our listeners who talks about dating with herpes and some of the challenges that she has experienced disclosing her STI status. Let's listen.
So for me, I can kind of just like drag things out and be like, talking and going on dates for kind of a long time. It'll just like sex just like doesn't happen. So it's kind of funny how people, when I do end up disclosing my status to them, the reactions of like, oh, so that's why.
That was one of our listeners in Durham. I'm here with sex and culture critic Ella Dawson, sex educator Tanya Bass, and Dr. Peter Leone. Ella, I'd love for you to respond to that clip. I know one of the most common reasons people land on your site on Google is they are Googling, should I date someone with herpes? So, I mean, what is your approach to disclosing your status, and what are those conversations like for you?
Yeah, I'm a strange case because if you Google me, you already know that I have herpes. So at this point, I very rarely find myself on a date with someone who doesn't already know my status. And I've also been in a committed relationship for quite some time. But when I was first dating as a newly diagnosed person, my approach was to get it out of the way early, mostly because I'm kind of a loudmouth person and I blurt out whatever is troubling me. So I tended to talk about it pretty early. It was something that was on my mind. And it was also something that I was writing about as a sexuality major in college. So I got it out of the way early. And I actually really loved that approach because it saved me the awkwardness and the heartbreak of becoming really invested in someone and then having them change their mind. But I also found that when I approached the conversation from a place of curiosity and passion of, I have this virus, it's not really a big deal, it's really strange how socially stigmatized it is, and I brought an energy of excitement and not shame, I received a much better response from the person that I was disclosing to. And I think a lot of folks with herpes are dreadfully afraid of rejection, and as a result can drag out disclosing or avoid it, or when they finally do disclose, they might apologize or frame it as this awful secret and this awful baggage that they're bringing to the relationship. And then that energy of shame and fear is mirrored by the person you're speaking to, who then sees it as this big scary thing and this potential deal breaker because that's how you framed it. So the advice that I usually give to folks who are newly diagnosed or who are dating for the first time is don't be afraid and don't apologize, because this is just part of your life. It's just part of who you are. And at the end of the day, you are an amazing, well-rounded person. And this one piece of your life shouldn't be a reflection of everything that you bring to the relationship.
Tanya, I'd love your thoughts. I think what Ella mentioned of kind of setting the tone by how you frame it from the start is such an important part of kind of any conversation we have about something challenging. But what are your recommendations for folks who are navigating this, either with a potential romantic partner or even just with friends, with folks that they would like to get support from?
Yeah, I think it's really important to normalize the conversation, thinking about how common sexually transmitted infections, in particular herpes, are, and how, in fact, people don't often know that they have it. I know earlier we were talking about signs and symptoms, and sometimes people have outbreaks and they're not aware of what they are, especially their first one, or they may think it's something else. So I think we normalize the conversation. I think Dr. Leone mentioned how there's different strands of the virus. And so even if we dig deep into that message of normalizing it, we don't have these conversations of fear and stigma around chickenpox, which is in the same family of virus. And so if we think about it, is a health challenge, it's something that we'd like to prevent in individuals, but it's certainly something that is very common and something that can be managed.
Dr. Leone, I mean, when we talk about how common it is and how many of us don't may not know that we have it, should we all get tested? I mean, it's not a part of a normal STI testing battery, so it's something you would have to ask for independently. But do you recommend that people err on the side of doing that because they may be walking around and passing it to other people without knowing it?
Yeah, we've had a lot of debate about this. I've been on the CDC STD treatment guidelines in the past, and we could never get agreement from them on making this a routine part of STI screening. Most of us who work in the field of herpes think that it should be discussed and offered. However, there's some caveats in that the blood tests need to be able to distinguish between type 1 and type 2. And if you turn up to be positive on the blood test for HSV2, it's important to know what your HSV1 status is. One, because you could still transmit HSV1 to someone, but also we need that to be able to interpret the blood test and make sure that it's an accurate diagnosis. I do think it's a good idea to get screened for herpes. Certainly, as you age up, the prevalence rate goes up, but that also means that your partner should know their status. So part of the reason, again, to have this discussion is the misnomer, I think, that people know what their status is for herpes on the basis of they didn't have any quote-unquote outbreaks. So I just think that it just levels the playing field to say, look, we're going to be responsible. We'll get an HIV test. We'll get tested for gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, and we're going to get a herpes blood test.
Tanya, you've looked a bit at North Carolina's sex ed curriculum and how herpes is talked about. What have you learned from that analysis that may shape, you know, how we all are walking around thinking about herpes?
Yeah, I like to believe that North Carolina has come a long way in the sexual health curriculum with the establishment of the Healthy Youth Act in 2009. I'm not going to say that it's perfect or ideal, but we definitely have some opportunities to discuss herpes in general. So in part of the mandate from the state, it's required that students are provided medically accurate information about STIs, STDs, and HIV. It's important that they also talk about healthy relationships. And for me, the opportunity lies in there where your communication is part of healthy relationships. And it doesn't matter if it's an intimate partner relationship or just, you know, platonic friendship. Having conversations about STIs and dealing with them and being aware is very important. I think we have some way to go in our curriculum, but I definitely know the opportunity is there for young people to become more educated.
I want to hear another clip from one of the listeners we heard from earlier from Durham talking about the variety of reactions that she has received when she has disclosed her STI status with folks.
There's been such a range of responses that I've received from people in the moment that I disclosed to a potential sexual partner that I have herpes. So like someone one time was like told me that I would be ruining his life. And that was really, really hard to hear. You would think that would be like the worst, worst thing to say. But the thing is that this person expressed how he felt. And we were able to continue that conversation. And we didn't end up having a physical relationship, but we worked through that. And we ended up with a good friendship. The actual worst thing that people do is ghost you. That's the worst thing that people do. And that happens maybe 40% of the time in my personal experience. I would say that is like the worst thing that someone could say, is to not say anything and to just disappear and to never kind of express, wow, okay, I'm not comfortable with that. So I think, you know, it's hard to say this to you, but I'm not interested in pursuing a relationship anymore. The best reaction that I've ever received from someone was, okay, I trust you to tell me what's safe and fun.
That's one of our listeners in Durham. I'm here with Ella Dawson, sex and culture critic, Dr. Peter Leone of the UNC School of Medicine, and Tanya Bass, Southern sexologist and sex educator. So, Ella, I love that clip because it kind of, you know, walks us through the range of reactions from best to worst and points to, I mean, how kind of the isolation around feeling, being afraid of disclosing can really prevent people from having healthy and safe relationships. And it's even led to some interesting things on the internet, like herpes exclusive dating sites. So I'm curious to have you talk a bit about that and kind of the what has emerged from the fact that so many people are afraid to disclose because they don't know how people are going to react.
Yeah, again, that fear of rejection that so many people feel is so powerful, and I don't want to discount it. I certainly remember being earlier in my status and being petrified of how people would respond. It's you're putting yourself in a vulnerable position when you tell someone, hey, this is a part of my life and I feel shame around it. Even if you know that shame is illogical, those feelings are still so powerful. And it's led to the creation of STI dating sites and dating apps. And I can understand the appeal that they have for folks who really struggle with disclosing, the idea of just having it not even be an issue. But at the same time, I personally don't use those sites. I worry that they benefit from stigma and reinforce the stigma because it encourages folks with STIs to self-segregate a little bit away from the general population. And for folks who don't have STIs who see the existence of those sites, it underlines for them that folks who have STIs are not dateable. So I have my own personal hot takes about those sites, but I do understand the desire for them and why there is such a market opportunity for their creation. But I love that clip that you played from a listener because it points to the fact that you can have so many different types of conversations and reactions from a herpes status and disclosure. And I've had the same experience. I've had people ghost, but I've also had really wonderful, hilarious interactions where folks will make a herpes joke and I'll say, you know, that's insensitive and you're speaking to someone who has herpes, and they might start immediately Googling STI statistics on their phone. And by the end of the night, they've asked me on a date. So I think that people can sometimes be their worst selves and react from a place of ignorance, but they might still be really receptive to learning and changing their mind. A lot of folks just don't realize that they've absorbed these harmful messages about STIs and are really quick to learn because they are at their heart a good person. So if someone does react negatively at first, as long as they're not being cruel, I think that we should leave some space for folks to have that initial freaked out reaction and then realize this is really silly and disproportionate and I do really like this person.
One other important thing to note in this conversation, Tanya, is that this virus can impact folks differently based on healthcare access. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that and how that plays into the conversation.
Yeah, when Dr. Leone was talking about suppressive therapy, you know, having that opportunity to utilize that based on your diagnosis also brings into point, you know, access to healthcare. And oftentimes, marginalized communities don't often have the access or the information to access that type of service. So even with our current standing for or requirements for the Healthy Youth Act in schools, it also requires that teachers are providing information about resources regarding testing and treatment for all STIs and STDs. As we think about young people, as we think about older adults or, you know, young adults, we're fortunate that in many of our institutions here in North Carolina, as far as universities, that we have student health and counseling services where there are pharmacists or ability to receive treatment for herpes. So I think that we have to understand that everyone may not have access to it, but we need to break down the barriers so that they can access the treatment.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of time left, but I would love to end with a bit of a kind of analysis about the kinds of conversations that we have about herpes and STIs and the kinds of conversations that we're having right now about COVID-19. Peter, I wonder, I mean, if you think there are lessons to be learned from experiences with coaching patients and coaching those with a positive herpes diagnosis and coaching the general public right now about COVID-19, any takeaways that you have?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of this issue around shame and stigma is there for COVID-19 as well. I mean, we sort of joke among some of my friends about not COVID shaming if someone acquires a coronaviral infection. We certainly recommend people being safe, but I actually worry that in the middle of this pandemic, we've actually lost talking about sex and ways to have safe and healthy sex. Mm. And so as a result, I actually think that some folks are probably practicing less safe sex because they are feeling guilty about wanting to be sexually active. How do you meet people? And God forbid they should disclose that they had sex because then coronavirus comes up. So I do think we need to continue to have these kind of conversations and recognize that a pandemic doesn't mean we need to stop being sexual.
I only have about 30 seconds left, Ella, but any reflections about the connection between the two from you?
Yeah, the pandemic has been really entertaining for me in a dark way because I've been having conversations about safer practices in the context of my sexual relationships with someone who has an STI. And it's been kind of fun to teach my family and my friends how to have these uncomfortable conversations about risk assessment and how you're socializing and the choices that you're making. So my hope is that while we don't really know yet how COVID will impact the way that we feel about STIs, that we all might learn some useful language and conversation skills that we can bring to the safer sex that we'll be having in the future.
My guests are Ella Dawson, a sex and culture critic, Dr. Peter Leone, a professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine, and Tanya Bass, Southern sexologist and sex educator. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You can find more about all of our guests and the rest of the Embodied series at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.